My guest here today is Jeff Smith, and Jeff is a very successful single-family real estate investor, which is why I'm very excited to be talking to you, Jeff. And let's just dive right into this and get started, and let's start with finding out, how many properties have you purchased?
Oh, I'd say at least 60.
60 properties. So how long of a time span has that been? When did you get started?
I started about 10 years ago.
10 years ago?
Yeah.
All right. So with 60 properties, now you don't own all 60 now, do you?
No. I've owned as many as 25 at one time. Today I have 18. In addition to the properties I've purchased, I've managed at least 120 at one time.
So you've managed up to 120 at one time, but at any given time, you've owned up to about 25 at a particular time?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So how do you manage so many properties all at the same time without just not even having a life?
Well, it's just a matter of putting into place rules and systems, and it's really not that difficult. You dumb it down to a point where you can get even teenage help part time to handle the anything administrative, and the rest you just hire out.
Okay, so that's really interesting. You say you can go get teenage help. That almost implies that some of the things that you're doing managing doesn't require a high degree of skill or knowledge necessarily. So I want to explore that a little bit. What kinds of things could teenagers do? And in the context of, you know, people that are watching this interview are thinking, well, I don't know if I can manage properties. So is that something they can do?
Well, it certainly is. Any of the administrative work they can do, filing, any of the bookkeeping, you can teach a teenager data entry, and it's just addition and subtraction for the bookkeeping. So at the level of 120 properties at a time, you would need to stay on top of that on a daily, if not weekly, basis. And a part-time teenager can handle that and then some. In terms of sales or leasing or anything like that, I think there are 10 or 12 scenarios that would come up in the process of a leasing call, and I pre-wrote the scripts for my nieces to use when they take those calls, and it hasn't been a problem.
Okay, excellent. So I want to make sure that we dive into those things a little bit later in the interview, because I think that our listeners will be really interested in understanding, how do you lease a property? What should you be saying, and what those scripts are that you've written for your niece, for example. But before we get into that, you have at any given time maybe up to 25 properties. So how much cash flow have you been able to gain, and over the time of doing your investing?
Sure. I guess the last time I looked at it, it was just after the last time I protested property taxes, and the average was about just under $300 per property.
Okay.
I'm also a real estate agent. Most of my clients today are purchasing properties significantly higher than that. But some of my properties were I bought when $200 a month was good cash flow, and they've come up. And so I guess on the average, $280, $290 per property.
Now, the ones that you bought that were $200 a cash flow or $200 a month cash flow prior, you said they're higher now. Is that what's the reason for that?
Well, we stay on top of our assessed value from the county for taxes. So usually our insurance, our property taxes stay in check. We make sure that the properties are leased just below market rents. So that goes up just about every year. So we try not to get behind on rent raises. As a matter of fact, that's another system we have where we just have a tickler file where a property comes up 60 days prior to the lease expiration date. And at that point, we start gearing for a renewal.
Okay. So you're increasing your cash flow by making sure your property taxes are as low as possible, and the rents are generally going up each year, so that your expenses may be staying the same or going down a little bit if you can successfully protest your taxes down.
Sure.
And with the rents going up, that just increases that cash flow.
Right. The expenses typically do go down, not just from tax savings, but also, you know, we put a maintenance program in place where we have eyes on the property once a quarter, and it's generally not my eyes, but whoever goes out there to do some value add, and it's presented that way as a value add to the customer, where we go out and either clean the carpets or exterminate or check the air conditioner, check the window locks, door locks, smoke alarms, that kind of a thing. But what we're really doing is going out there and doing something to the property that will increase the life expectancy of some component.
Okay.
And at the same time, we're getting an inspection. Whoever goes out there has a form that they use to report back to me on the condition of the property. And so we have eyes on the property often enough. We have a program in place where there's just very little that comes up that's unexpected.
Okay. So by having the right program or system in place, you're able to minimize the number of unexpected things that come up. Everything goes pretty smoothly once you implement that and get that system in place.
Absolutely. Right?
Okay. So, and that's another thing I'm just making a note here I want to talk about in just a little bit is what that system is. What I'd like to talk about now is how did you get into real estate investing? What was your motivation?
Well, you know how everybody in their family has the one guy that everybody else avoids? In my family, that man is my father-in-law. And he has 75, 80 houses somewhere in that neighborhood. And, you know, to me, 10, 12 years ago, he came across as somebody who was bragging about it all the time. When the reality was, I was married to his daughter. He wanted me, or he wanted a life for his daughter that reached his expectations for her. And I believe he thought that the way to make that happen is to make me a believer. And so he came to the restaurant that I worked at. At the time, I was running my parents' restaurants. They had three locations here in Houston. And it was after a Lifestyles case study, he and a group of folks showed up for dinner and drinks. And he sort of cornered me and mentioned to me, the benefits of real estate and what it had done for him. And again, I thought he was bragging.
Do you remember what those benefits were? What were the sales points he was making?
I really don't. The part of the conversation that stands out to me is how hard I tried to get away from it. And so my exit from the conversation was a question. Look, can you just refer me to a few books I can read to get me so I can pick this up? I'm busy, I'm working, I don't have time to, I've got to get back to work. So he referred me to Rich Dad, Poor Dad, The Richest Man in Babylon, and I believe the third book was The E-Myth. So I read those books, and this happened in October of 1999, I believe.
Okay.
By Thanksgiving, the following month, I had read all three books and was so interested that I pursued him all over my mom's house, trying to ask him. He tried to get away from me just as hard as I tried to get away from him.
So the roles had kind of reversed.
That's right. So his exit to get out of that conversation was this: look, if you can get your wife to read these books as well, then what I'll do is I'll pay for you to go to school to learn this stuff. And so she had read the books by Christmas, and at, you know, at Christmas dinner, we were both chasing him around. And he you know, the school that he paid for us to go to was the 2-day class at Lifestyles.
Okay. So that was where you got some more education. Obviously, the books made an impact on you because you went from saying, well, I'm not really that interested in this. It sounds like a lot of work, maybe. I've got other things to do, working in the restaurant. What was it that you read in those books that changed your perspective to where you were now pursuing him?
Well, oddly enough, none of the three books were about real estate. The Richest Man in Babylon was a book that, it was such a small book, such a basic book, I finished it in an hour and a half or 2 hours. And I thought, oh my gosh, I wasn't sure if I learned something, because it seemed like it was obvious. And then after I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, I was so upset that I didn't figure out the formula on my own, because it was that simple. And then through conversations with him, applying it to real estate, it made the difference. And I guess I went from one family business, the restaurant business, to another family business, the real estate or real estate investing.
And so that was about 10 years ago, I guess, because you've been doing this for about 10 years.
Yes.
So when you read these books and you got excited about it, you went to your father-in-law, wanted to know more, was he willing to teach you, or did you have to continue to pursue him for that?
He wouldn't talk to me until after I had taken the 2-day class with here at Lifestyles with Del Walmsley. And after that, yeah, absolutely, he was available, made himself readily available. Well, first of all, it contributed to the quality of life for his daughter, so I'm sure that was a motivating factor. But also, you know, real estate and providing clean, safe, functional homes that working families can afford is a passion for him, and as well as for me. So it was a way for us to grow together.
So do you remember the first house that you purchased once he started working with you? You went to the classes at Lifestyles Unlimited. But what did you feel, what were your concerns when you went to go purchase that first house?
Well, the first house that I bought was a $30,000 house in a part of town that I never would have even thought would have been a profitable place to buy a house. Matter of fact, I bought two houses in that same subdivision within a month or so of each other. You know, I didn't know anything about construction, anything about rehab, and this house looked like... It looked like it should have been condemned. Since then, I've come to figure, you know, that was one of the, you know, that was probably an average sort of condition for what I've done. I've done both the house that didn't need anything, you know, bought a property that, yeah. There have been a couple of properties where it was just put a sign in the yard and lease it the next day.
So no rehab on those necessarily. They were ready to go.
Right. So I've been at both ends of the spectrum. A pretty major rehab compared to a $10 sign, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was probably right in the middle.
Okay.
Middle. An example of I got impatient with the guys installing the fixtures, and I was so ignorant that when I took a light fixture down to hang a ceiling fan up in the master bedroom, I didn't know what those strings were. I took the screws out, and then there were strings holding this fixture up, so I took a pair of scissors and cut them. It popped.
Yeah, because the electricity was still on, I would imagine.
That's right. So that's how ignorant I was about it. Yeah. And so I guess there's virtue there in reducing your ignorance, and as well as having some patience.
So you were patient. There were some things that you didn't know. You went ahead and proceeded anyways. Did you make any mistakes along the way?
I've made some mistakes. I think really they can all boil down to it can all be reduced to not following the system that has already been proven to be effective. For example, one of the bigger mistakes I made was, I guess in 2004, 2005, just before the real peak of the real estate market in 2006, this was a period where anybody that could buy a house could, anybody that wanted a house could buy a house.
Because the financing was so easy to get.
Financing was no problem. So the tenant pool was smaller. And my thinking at the time was I basically outsmarted myself. I thought, you know, these old guys, think Dell and Bruce, my father-in-law and Dell Walmsley, they don't know what they're talking about with this charge less rent. I'm going to charge more. But I'm going to require a lower deposit. See, okay. Deposits, I thought, well, deposits on my books are a liability. Rent is income. Why not get more income and have less liability? Well, that didn't work. In a tough market, you charge less rent. And you drop the rent a little bit, not your standards.
So by dropping the rent, what does that do? How does that help you as the investor, as the landlord?
Well, if you're charging more rent than the market dictates, then you're going to attract people who don't intend to pay you anyway. So they'll move in, pay for a couple of months, and they're gone. If you charge a lower rent, you get to choose who moves in. So if you're the best product at the best price in the neighborhood, who's going to look at your property? Everybody looking in that area. Right. And if they come to look at yours, and yours is one of the least expensive properties, if not the least expensive property, and then they go look at one or two others, which one are they going to want? They're going to want the cheap one that's also the better one, or at least equivalent.
Right. So yeah. Is that the strategy you use then to make sure that you get good tenants in the property that are going to take good care of the property and pay their rent on time?
And stay longer than 12 months. My typical turnover is 2 years and 9 months. I'm trying to get that up to 3 years. That's my next operational goal.
Okay. Excellent. And how long do you generally keep a property where you've had so many over the years, you've bought and sold them, rented them out and everything, but what do you typically keep them for?
Well, if I can refinance it, well, let me back up. If after the first year I have a buyer, it's gone. I sell it as soon as I can after that first year. But typically if I haven't sold it in 3 years, I'll probably refinance it. If I haven't refinanced it in 3 years, I'm going to make a diligent effort to sell it in five. And if I did refinance it in that third year, I'll probably sell it by the seventh year.
Okay. So you don't really keep properties longer than seven. That would kind of be your upper limit.
Right.
Is that right?
Okay. Right. I still have that first one, though.
You do have that.
Still have the first one. I don't know if it's sentimental. My friend Natalie also has her first one still.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's interesting. I actually sold my first house before I bought my second house.
Is that right?
I didn't have any sentimental value attached to it. So what are some, people that are watching, listening to the things that you're saying, are thinking about getting into real estate investing, what are some tips that you have for them? What would you tell somebody who's just getting started based on what you've learned from your successful experience?
Well, I think that I think that there are probably three things that are at the top of what I think are more important than anything else. The third most important thing would be developed systems. We talked about that earlier. Leasing is a system, management is a system, the rehab is a system. Every part of it can be broken down into a flow chart if you wanted to do that. And I have. I don't think that really you have to go that far. But just having a general plan for how you do things that can be repeated. The second most important thing would be not doing too much. I think most of the people that I see getting into this misunderstand best product, best price. I think that so many of my colleagues over rehab, or they do too much to the property or cut their price too much. if the lowest sold comparable, if the lowest rented comparable that comes up is say $900 a month, but the lowest active is $950. Well, I don't think you have to go below $900. $900 will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Or $895. I don't think you have to undercut so much. So they overdo it on the price reduction. They overdo it on the rehab. You just don't have to put expensive material into a rent house. You have to go and match the neighborhood, whatever the expectation of the neighborhood is, and maybe add one thing. Maybe that thing is a ceiling fan. Maybe that thing is a patio cover. Maybe that thing is microwave vent hood. It doesn't have to be more than what the neighborhood expects.
Okay.
And then the most important thing, I'm going to echo my father-in-law, Bruce, and he says, look, knowledge is only 20% of it. You're not going to get out there and learn everything there is to know about something. You're just going to have to get out there and try it. He's a big fan of dancing. He likes to dance, go out dancing. And when I took dancing lessons, you learn a few steps and then you go do those few steps, and then the teacher teaches you the next few steps. So he said the only 20% of it is that knowledge to get started. The rest of it, the other 80%, has to do with access to a mentor, somebody who can tell you what the next steps are. And I go back to Dell and Bruce on a regular basis for refreshers. As a matter of fact, I just took that 2-day class again this weekend.
So even though you've been doing this for so many years, you've done so many properties, you still go back to mentors, you still go back to the people who have taught you and get a refresh on what to do and just make sure that you're still on top of things.
I think Andrew Carnegie called it a mastermind group, so I would encourage you to build one.
Excellent. So let's dig a little bit into the systems that you have. And, of course, we don't have time in this format to get into all the details. And as you just said, knowledge is only 20% of it. So I want to talk about the systems that you use just from the perspective so that our listeners can understand that they're not it's not super complex stuff that we're talking about here. It can be done, but just enough to give them an idea. Here are the systems. Here's how you approach a system. So, for example, perhaps we could talk about probably one of the big concerns people have is how am I going to lease a property and get tenants that are going to pay their rent on time and treat my property well and not trash it. So what's your leasing system that you have?
Well, in terms of leasing, there are three reasons why a property won't rent. From my perspective, it's price, it's condition, and it's the person who's leasing the property, the salesperson. Because that's what leasing is. It's a sales function of your real estate business. So let's make the assumption then that the price is right and the condition is right, that both of those are non-issues. Then in terms of getting the property leased, I just like to break things down into smaller, manageable parts. So let's just look at marketing. Is the phone ringing? Are you getting calls on the property? And I think there are some essential things that you have to do to get the phone to ring. Use a weekly classified paper. Just a line ad will do. In my market, that paper is the green sheet. A line ad and the green sheet should get you whole, I guess depending on where your property is situated in the neighborhood, these percentages could be off. But if you're on a cul-de-sac in the back of the neighborhood, your green sheet ad's going to get you 60% of your calls.
Mm-hmm.
If your property's on a main street in the neighborhood, it's going to get you 30% of your calls, but your yard sign is going to get the balance. There will be a few stragglers, straggling calls from other alternative sources, like I think you should have an internet presence, whether you put your property on a website like Craigslist or rentals.com would do it as well. You should have an internet presence. That way you can guide your calls. You can capture their email address and send them a flyer, and that flyer would be that website. My favorite place to find tenants, although it really only accounts for 5 or 10% of them, is from the neighbors at that property. One of the things that a lot of people are afraid is going to happen when a property becomes a rental property on their street, or when a property is for sale on their street, is that it'll become a rental property. They're afraid for that to happen.
Right.
And one of the things that I make it a point to do is when I acquire a property, I go meet the neighbors. And, let them know that I have standards, that they're... there's a criminal background check.
You're going to make sure, for their sake as well as yours, that you're not going to put somebody in there that will be a bad neighbor.
Right. And the other thing is, I'm going to give them incentive to provide the next tenant, the next resident, and I'll offer maybe a $50 gift card to a restaurant close by or something like that if the person they refer moves in. And that gets a couple of things done for me. One, it they're looking out for the house at that point.
Right.
And two, the tenant that moves in, if they're socially connected to the block, is going to stay longer.
Yeah.
So while 5 or 10% of my calls come from that source, over time, the percentage of residents from that source is higher than that, because they stay longer.
I see. Well, that's a great idea. So what percentage of time are you able to get referrals from the neighbors and actually lease out?
Oh, it's small. It's, like I said, 5 or 10%. Typically that being socially connected to the block will get them... I'll get an application from them sooner because I'll have the neighbor show them the house. And they'll just send me the application right away,
uh-huh.
And before I even have a chance to show the property. So while the leads from that source, it's a smaller group. Over time, it becomes a larger percentage of your customer base.
Okay, that idea is fascinating to me because while it may be a small percentage, the quality of the tenant is going to be much higher than if you just get them from other sources. And like you were saying, they're going to probably stay longer because they're socially connected to that neighborhood. So from all the different perspectives, it's worth making the effort to do that. Even though it may not happen every time, the quality is so much higher, that it's a great idea. I really like that.
And those are just three or four marketing ideas. I think that in terms of leasing, you also have the sales function. You've got to answer the phone, or have your niece answer the phone. I've provided scripts for that. And you know, once you go through the scripts a couple of times, after that it just becomes a conversation.
Right.
Once you realize the goal of the phone call isn't to make a sale, it's to make an appointment, or you just break it down into steps.
Okay. So, what's an example of the script that you gave to your niece? What was the gist of that?
Well, there are a couple of goals. Number one is to control the conversation, because when you receive the call, the you can imagine that the person who's calling is probably going through the green sheet line ads, going straight down the list. Everything that's in their price range, they're calling on. And most of the time, the questions they have are not really questions, because that information is...
It's in there already in the listing.
Already. So, and they're just getting a feel for you, trying to see if they would connect well with you. But the one thing they're worried about most of the time is, well... You know, what are the screening requirements? I don't want to give you a $35 application fee if I have a low likelihood of getting approved. The reality is, it's not that hard to get approved for a rental property. I'm going to check criminal background. I'm going to check rental background, and lately, particularly in current economic climate, everybody I'm looking at has some level of bad credit. So I really want to put them at ease with that. So the first thing is, when the phone call comes, for example, they'll identify themselves. I'm calling about the house you have for rent. Fantastic. My name's Jeff. What's yours? And then at that point, once you ask that first question, they'll give you the answer, and then I'll just give them a short description of the property. Well, this is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage home in Happy Town subdivision. It's got an open floor plan, ceiling fan in the master bedroom and in the living room. Got a covered patio or whatever it is. Does that sound like a good fit for your family? So end with another question.
So you ask these questions to control the conversation, and really kind of, it sounds like you're trying to connect with the person, because the technical details on the property, as you said, they already know that generally they're in the listing. So you ask questions, you get their feedback, guide the conversation, and connect with them. Help them feel comfortable. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So throughout the course of the conversation, I think one of the things that I want to do is make sure that I have an email address and a phone number. So I usually have the phone that I take the calls on has caller ID. So I always ask, is this the number you're calling from? Is this a good number for you? And can I email you some photographs and a map to the property and the floor plan or whatever I've got.
Anything to be able to connect with them still, right?
Right, right. And most of the time, well, when can I see the property is one of the questions they have. And I don't like to show one person a property. I want to schedule at least a half dozen appointments at one time. So I'll say, however, I won't say that in on the phone call. What I'm trying to do is make a hard appointment. I don't want to say, well, I'm going to be there from 6 to 7 on Tuesday night.
You want it to be a specific time that they feel some level of commitment to being there at that time.
Right, right. So I'll say I have 6 o'clock on Tuesday and 2 o'clock on Saturday available. Frankly, I don't believe it's going to make it until Saturday, but either way, which one works best for you? They'll probably make the appointment for Tuesday after that. Or whichever date is nearer.
Right.
I'll probably have 6 appointments, and 4 of them will show up. And you know, I want them to pass each other because it, again, creates a sense of urgency. They, you know, so they'll go ahead and submit the application.
Right.
There's another process for the application. What, you know, what standards are acceptable? You know, do you take the best one or you take the first one that meets your minimum standards? I prefer that way because, well, it the lease occur, you know, the leasing occurs quicker, and it keeps you out of trouble with fair housing. So you just have minimum standards. You let the first one that meets those standards and gets you the first month's rent and security deposit to your first. That's who gets the property.
Right.
But the idea is to, again, to create a system that anybody can manage. So you get the phone call, you make the appointment, then you send them the letter by email saying thanks for the call. You know, here's your here are some pictures of the property, a map to the property. Remember, as we talked about on the phone, these things go pretty quick. They're significantly under market. You might want to do a drive-by before the appointment. And I've got the window blinds open. You can see into every room from the outside. If it meets your expectations, then here's an application as well. Go ahead and get this back to me, and we can get you in even before your appointment.
Well, that's really good advice that you've been sharing on your system for doing the leases. Of course, you have systems for, I think you mentioned this, how to find houses, how to purchase the house, how to rehab the house, all those different steps. And, of course, we can't cover all those right now. You have so much knowledge that you've learned over the years that you have to share. But I think the main takeaway from this that I'm hearing as you're explaining this is that if you can... that these systems are not complicated. Yeah. You just need to understand what they are. And as you mentioned, that 20% knowledge, 80% is just get out and do it. You know, if you're working with people who know how to do this, you can learn as you go along. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going through a fitness program right now. And my trainer didn't teach me everything she knows about nutrition and everything she knows about exercise on the first day. Matter of fact, I'm a month into it, 8 pounds less, and I still just know only a fraction of what she knows, but I know enough to maintain progress.
So you knew enough to lose 8 pounds and that's maintain right. That progress, right? Well, congratulations. That's great.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's great. So what would you say has been like the biggest factor in your success over the last 10 years and doing all of this and generating so much cash flow and everything, what's the one thing that you would attribute to your success?
Huh. Well, I would imagine it's just having the foundation. Just, you know, there's a sense of peace in knowing that, I guess I don't really know how to put my finger on it, but there's such a foundation with everybody that I'm around, that it's just, there's no longer fear. The fear that was there in the beginning is gone.
You don't feel that at all,
right?
And that's because you've surrounded yourself with other people who are doing the same thing, succeeding at it, and so your belief in it working, based on your own experience and other people's, is just very strong. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. It may be this. Thomas Stanley and William Danko wrote a book several years ago. It was published. It was called The Millionaire Next Door. And in that book, they did 11 years worth of research on where the wealth in this country is and how it got there. And what they determined was easily two-thirds of the millionaires in this country became millionaires through entrepreneurial efforts. So I think for me, the biggest fear was leaving a job with a regular paycheck, and which I didn't have to do. It took, you know, it took 2 years before I left my 2 years of doing this, of doing the real estate before I left my job. But the idea of that's the direction that I was going seemed risky to me. And even though my dad is a contractor, plumbing contractor, so he's got the entrepreneurial mindset. My stepfather is a restaurateur, obviously an entrepreneurial mindset.
Right.
My father-in-law, real estate investor, entrepreneur. Even though I had all of that behind me, it was still overcoming fear. And I think the best way to do that is I guess to use your words, surround yourself with people who are doing what it is that you want to do, and learn from them.
Yeah. So when you look back at it now, you were working in the restaurant industry. It took you about 2 years to build up your real estate to the point where you were able to quit that job. Mm-hmm. How has it worked out for you?
Well, I was it was funny. My mom said to me that she was asked, oh, let's see, my daughter's almost seven, so this must have been just under 8 years ago. Well, yeah, that would work out. If I've been doing this over 10 years, and 2 years after I started, I quit my job. My mom was asked, well, how's Jeff doing? And she said, well, he's married. They're trying to have a baby. He doesn't have a job. and that was sort of a family joke for a while. But for the first 4 or 5 years of my daughter's life, I didn't work. You know, I went out and tinkered with my properties. And then you know, for 5 years I was I guess unemployed. Self-employed, however you want to call it.
You were living off of the money that your investments were generating.
Right,
which
right.
Wasn't a full-time job, based on what I'm hearing you say. You tinkered around with it, and so that freed you up to have time with your family, with your daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I guess about 5 years ago, Steve Davis, the vice president here at Lifestyles, asked me to come here and teach a few classes. So I started doing that, and now I'm working with folks as a real estate agent, getting them into the same kinds of deals that I've bought. And matter of fact, I had a client decide not to buy a property this weekend, so I'm going to buy it.
Oh, so you're going to buy it.
That's
the ultimate proof that you believe in what you're doing, right? Well, it's a wonderful story that you have, Jeff, because I think a lot of people who are watching this are in a job, and they're trying to look down the road and say, you know, I really want to be independent. I want to have that kind of flexibility so I can spend more time with my family or do things that I want to be doing, but I'm tied to this job because I need that paycheck. I've got to have that money. And they're looking at real estate investing saying, well, I see this as an avenue that can free me up and give me that independence and freedom, but not really confident maybe that I can actually do that. You're a great example of just a regular guy like the rest of us who had a job, got into this, took a couple of years, and then you were able to move on and do the things with your life that you wanted to. So it's a great story, great inspiration. I really appreciate your time and your willingness to share these thoughts and ideas with us. And do you have any last words to add as we're wrapping this up?
Nike, just take action. Do it.
Just do it. Excellent words of advice. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.